It's 36 in Middletown, 35 in Steelens Grove, and 32 in Newport. And today's Radio Smart Talk has an interesting concept as its topic, and I'm just going to let Craig Cohen tell you about it.
All right. Well, first of all, Tim, I just want to say this.
Yes.
Shaquille O'Neal, 15 years ago, was a professional athlete. Today, he's a sports personality.
Mm.
There you go.
That's the definition for me.
There you go. Yeah, coming up, you're right. Today on Radio Smart Talk, we have a fascinating topic for you. We're going to discuss the implications of incorporating ethical protocols into autonomous robots for use in warfare. Imagine one of those Predator drones is tasked with taking out an enemy, but concludes for a pre-programmed ethical reason that it should disregard its orders. I know that kind of sounds like science fiction, but science fiction has a way of becoming science fact, and we will talk with the researcher that's sort of at the forefront of this, conducting this research for the U.S. Army. That's coming up on Radio Smart Talk in about 9 minutes, and we'll welcome your questions and comments as always.
Let us know what you think about the programs you hear on 93.3. Trusted information from WITF. Call 717-704-3000 or email us anytime at fm@witf.org.
The U.S. Army wants to develop robots that can weigh military objectives against civilian harm. Imagine you've programmed a Predator drone to fire a weapon at a sworn enemy, but you've also programmed it to consider the ethical and moral implications of what it's doing, and it ultimately decides not to fire. We are closer to that reality than you might think. In his book, Governing Lethal Behavior in Autonomous Robots, Dr. Ronald Arkin explores the ethical dilemmas inherent in his own work, developing machines that can use reason and ethics to form decisions. Today on Radio Smart Talk, we'll explore the challenges, advancements Arkin and his colleagues are working on will present us with in the years to come, from the technical to the ethical. We'll also talk with Dr. Peter Asaro, a self-proclaimed philosopher of science, technology, and media, and founding member and co-director of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. Resistance is futile. Our conversation begins after the news.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working through its Pew Health Group to advance safe credit card practices at pewtrusts.org.
Good morning and welcome to Radio Smart Talk. I'm Craig Cohen. Time was, scientists in the field of robotics had to regularly convince the public of what they could do. Thanks in large part to science fiction and movies, TV and books, roboticists today have to convince people of what they can't do. But science fiction does have a way of, over time, becoming science fact. Among recent examples, we've seen the increase in the use of so-called predator drones, unmanned aircraft, and weaponry used on the battlefield. Dr. Ronald Arkin has been conducting research for the U.S. Army focused on incorporating ethical protocols into such autonomous robots. Imagine you've programmed a predator drone to fire a weapon at an enemy, but you've also programmed it to consider the ethical and moral implications of what it's doing, and it ultimately decides whether or not to fire. Today on the program, we explore the challenges advancements Dr. Arkin and his colleagues are working on will present us with in the years to come, from the technical to the ethical. Dr. Ron Arkin is Regents Professor and Director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory and Associate Dean of Research in the College of Computing at Georgia Tech. His latest book is Governing Lethal Behavior in Autonomous Robots. Dr. Ron Arkin, welcome to Radio Smart Talk. Dr. Arkin, are you with us? All right. Looks like we're going to have to see if we can get things squared away. For some reason, we're not hearing Dr. Arkin, but we'll try and figure that out. Also joining us this morning is Dr. Peter Asaro, a self-proclaimed philosopher of science, technology, and media, and founding member and co-director of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. Dr. Asaro, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm not sure where Dr. Arkin is, but we'll try and get that squared away here in just a couple of minutes. As we begin our conversation, we welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. We also want to hear from our mobile community. You can now text us at 35253, type WITF space, and then your comment or question. That's 35253 WITF space, and your comment or question. We also encourage you to answer our poll question on this issue on the Smart Talk page at WITF.org. And again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Asaro, let's obviously begin with you, since we're trying to find Dr. Arkin on the line here, and I think it may be just a technical problem at our end. at the heart of what Dr. Arkin is talking about and working on is a way to, as he sees it, responsibly reduce, if not eliminate, the human factor in war. Back in 2005, Tim Weiner of New York Times spoke with Gordon Johnson from the Joint Forces Command at the Pentagon about robot soldiers. And I want to read this quote to you. Johnson told him, "They don't get hungry. They're not afraid. They don't forget their orders. They don't care if the guy next to them has just been shot. Will they do a better job than humans? Yes." And, of course, in the ensuing years, we have seen more and more of these Predator drones in operation in Afghanistan and Iraq. Why is it a bad idea to turn even portions of the ugliness of war over to robots?
Well, I think the crucial thing is really the autonomy of the decision-making about lethality. So if you're letting the robots make the decisions about when to pull the trigger and who's going to die or what's going to be a valid target or an invalid target, I think that's where the dangerous territory really lies. And a lot of the Predator drones that are currently being used in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan are not autonomous in that sense. They're still being controlled by people at the other end who are very highly trained and very skilled at making the kinds of decisions about what's a valid target and what's appropriate under the laws of warfare and morality in terms of the targets that they choose. So what Ron's really proposing is a way of automating that you could incorporate into the robot some computer program that's going to simulate those laws of warfare or the ethics that humans use, and that the robot will sort of do that. And because they're computers, and they might do that better than humans, but I don't think that's the case.
Let me see if we have Dr. Arkin on the line now. Dr. Arkin, are you with us? Nope. Okay. All right. We're going to keep working on that. In the meantime, Dr. Asaro, what do you think of the notion that robots properly programmed with certain ethical protocols could perform more ethically than human beings in the field of battle?
Yeah. So there's kind of two parts to that. So one is I don't know that they're really performing ethically. I mean, just because a robot follows a set of behaviors that in a human we might call ethical doesn't necessarily mean they're doing ethics. I'm trained as a philosopher, and what ethics really is within philosophy is moral deliberation that you go through and how you determine what's valuable in your behavior or what's valuable as a goal for your life. And the robots really aren't doing that, right? What they're at best going to do under Ron's format is follow rules that we've developed for ethics. And those rules are really meant to govern human deliberation and thinking about complicated ethical situations. And the robots aren't going to think about them, right? They're just going to do what the rules tell them to do. So they're not really deliberating what's right or wrong in a certain situation. They're going to just follow the rules. So in that sense, it's not really ethics in the way that we think about ethics within humans. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, then you can say, well, are they going to follow those rules better than humans? If we can all agree on what those rules are, which, of course, humans don't agree on what those rules are quite a lot. And there, I think there's very real technical challenges as far as if you were to come up with some set of rules that we could all agree on, how well would the robots actually follow those, and how would we evaluate how well they follow those? The world is very complicated, and technologies are notoriously bad at conforming to human rules. if you look at even a technology like Google, which gets used a lot, and we've, engineers and scientists have been working for more than a decade, on refining it, and you can still type in a query into Google and get something very unexpected, right? And the world is very unpredictable from the perspective of a logic-based computer. And the chances that a robot's not going to know what to do in a given situation or that it will really do the wrong thing is very likely. And when they're armed with lethal weapons, the consequences of that are very dangerous.
We, in fact, have had an example already this morning of technology not working on our behalf. And let me check and see if we do now have Dr. Ron Arkin on the line. Dr. Arkin, good morning.
Good morning. I'm here, Craig. Sorry if there was a hitch earlier.
That's all right. No problem. Hey, I mentioned at the beginning of the show Predator drones. Can you share some other examples of how robots are already being deployed on the battlefield?
Oh, there's many different instances, of course. You've all, if you've seen the Oscar-nominated film, The Hurt Locker, you saw an explosive ordnance disposal robot. I think that was a Talon. But there are also PackBots out there, which are used in support of our troops. These are unarmed systems, but intended to keep soldiers out of harm's way for the dismantling of improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. There are armed platforms in the field. The Talon Swords platform is one example. It has not fired a shot yet, to my knowledge, but it is present with the troops at this point. There are many other systems under development. The Mars system, which is a system that has been designed by Kinetic from the ground up. There are Reapers, of course, which are the predators on steroids. There's undersea vehicle torpedoes, fire and forget, loitering missiles, all sorts of different applications. And by some definitions, you can even argue that landmines and anti-tank mines are robotic systems because they sense the environment and they actuate, in some cases, just by exploding.
Now, you outline in your book many, many projects that you've developed or assisted in developing for the U.S. military over the years. Why have you now turned your attention to the notion of incorporating ethical protocols into the work that you do?
Well, as a curiosity-driven scientist from the onset, from 25 years plus ago, I was very much concerned with the understanding of intelligence and how we could make machines do things in different ways. I've had funding not only from the military, but the National Science Foundation, various corporations and the like. But in the United States, the military is a major supporter of academic research, not only our labs, but labs all over the country, and in some cases around the world as well. So many, many years ago, it was hard to get anyone to believe a robot could do anything. And now it's morphed into the task of making sure that people understand that robots can't do everything in this case. I heard Peter mentioning again the limits that we are currently faced with in many cases in terms of technology expectations and management. But nonetheless, I became aware that the technology that not only our laboratory was creating, but we as a collective group of roboticists was starting to move out of our laboratories and into the real world and into the battlefield. And the weaponization of these systems appears to be inevitable, ethical or otherwise. And for those particular reasons, I feel it's important, and I feel partially responsible, that we make sure that these systems, if they are to be used at all in this particular context, are deployed in a manner that is consistent with the internationally agreed upon laws of war.
And the direction we seem to be going that you're suggesting is moving towards what you characterize as autonomous robots, those that can sort of carry out their missions on their own without any human intervention. Is that
not exactly? Autonomy is a nebulous thing to define, and I'm sure Peter, who's a philosopher, will give you a different perspective in terms of free will than I, as a roboticist, would. And often as the military would as well, too. It's kind of a slippery slope where you have the humans making decisions at the very smallest level in terms of radio-controlled, actually observing it, to a teleoperated system where the human is a distance away, to a semi-autonomous system where the robot has the capability to do certain things on its own, such as obstacle avoidance, to more difficult tasks where the robot, as it becomes more and more autonomous, starts to make decisions on its own, in some cases perhaps involving the application of lethal force. But that's not to say that there isn't a human being somewhere involved in the decision-making. There's a flashpoint in this debate called human in the loop. It's been lately referred to as a human on the loop by the Air Force, and I just heard the Army at a recent meeting I was at in London calling it the leader in the loop. And this, to some extent, shows the evolution of where human beings are going to be in the phases of decision-making for these systems. But autonomy, inevitably, due to the ever-increasing tempo of the battlefield, is going to be pushed more and more towards the front end, the decision-making of the robotic side.
Well, let me ask you both, and I'll start with Dr. Rosaro. At what level of warfare should human beings be in the loop?
Well, I think definitely when it comes to lethal decision-making, that there needs to be humans in that loop, because that's where responsibility lies. If something does go wrong and there's a you know, innocents are killed or a war crime is committed, there needs to be an individual person who's responsible for that. And to the degree that the systems are made autonomous, it's possible for people to say, well, it wasn't my fault. The system went awry, or that system made that decision, and the robot did it, and so I can't be put on trial, or it's not my fault. So I think we need to avoid those kinds of situations. And as Ron was saying, I mean, it's determined by, you know, the laws of war, the international agreed upon conventions about war, and I don't see why we couldn't add a new law of war that says that we're not allowed to use autonomous robotic systems for lethal decision making.
Dr. Arkin, at what level of warfare do you think human beings should be in the loop?
Well, it's an interesting question as well, too. And the issue is when we should permit this particular level of human beings to be in the loop. The notion is that a human must be in the loop just as they are currently in commanding soldiers. When any soldier is given a task, there's a human in the loop. There is a mission. There is a commander. Someone gives orders to that particular individual. They should be constrained by the laws of war and the rules of engagement. And unfortunately, our performance, I should say first and foremost, I have the utmost respect for our young men and women in the battlefield. They are put in situations where human beings are not expected to perform or not capable of performing as well as they could. And in many cases, things do not turn out from a humanitarian perspective or an ethical perspective well at all. And I think Peter will acknowledge the fact that atrocities are an ever-present situation in warfare. So getting back to this question, I believe we can't micromanage these systems at one level. If you are going to insist that for every single target designation, that a human must verify and allow and certify that that is a legitimate target, one of two things is going to happen. One of those things is the system will be destroyed by the time the human being has made that particular decision due to the ever-increasing tempo of the battlefield, as I mentioned. Or two, the human will be unfairly assumed to have taken responsibility for that with having a soda straw view of the world, and not fully understanding the actions that they are undertaking. There are instances of this in the Kuwaiti war that we had over a decade ago. This is only anecdotal information, but when a Patriot missile battery comes on, the operator has 10 seconds to push a button and disable it. That target is automatically generated by the Patriot missile system, as I understand it. And there was no instance, again, only anecdotally, of any human being ever turning that system off. To some extent, the operator is in a no-win situation under those cases. He can be responsible, and he will be the scapegoat for responsibility in this case. He doesn't have enough information to be, doesn't have enough information to be able to intelligently make a decision in that very narrow time frame. So if we're really talking about responsibility, we have to ensure that the human beings who are operating these systems have that capability.
So essentially you're saying you think robots can ultimately be more humane than human beings in the field of battle.
That is the thesis that I'm operating under, and I contend due to the circumstances of modern warfare, that is not a very difficult thing to do. I do not say that these systems will be perfect. I do not say that they will not make mistakes. But I do say, and I do believe, until proven otherwise, and I'll be the first to admit it if I can be proven otherwise, that these systems can ultimately, and the phrase is ultimately, if we do appropriate research, do better than human beings in the battlefield from an ethical perspective. And that translates into a reduction in non-combatant casualties, which means it's actually saving lives.
This is Radio Smart Talk. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the implications of incorporating ethical protocols into autonomous robots for use in warfare with Dr. Ronald Arkin, director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory at Georgia Tech, who's been conducting just such research for the U.S. Army, and Dr. Peter Asaro, founding member and co-director of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. We welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-729-7532, or you can email us at smarttalk@witf.org. We also want to hear from our mobile community on this issue. What do you think of Dr. Arkin's research? Could ethically programmed robots be more humane in the field of battle than humans? Text us at 35253, type WITF, space, and then leave your comment. That's 35253, type WITF, space, and your comment. And again, our phone number is 1-800-729-7532. And we begin this morning with Richard in Ephrata. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Craig. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Thank you. Real good. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a problem with trying to put ethics in war to begin with. There's nothing ethical about war. It's killing. You're putting robots in there to do the killing for us. You're making it too clean, too easy. No reason for not having war, basically. And it's, you know, before long, you're going to have people sitting on both sides of the ocean and just pushing buttons and nobody getting killed.
Dr. Asaro, if we do ultimately deploy autonomous robots to conduct our wars by eliminating or at least significantly reducing the involvement of human soldiers, I mean, aren't we also dramatically reducing a major deterrent in the decision to go to war in the first place?
I think so, very much. A lot of what prevents countries from going to war is the fear of casualties. And what robot systems like this are really doing is promising to reduce casualties, if we believe Iran, on both sides of the battle. And it's about shifting risk on the one hand. But if we really look at how they're being used right now, they're really shifting risk away from soldiers and towards civilians in a lot of cases. And even if we look at how they're being used in Pakistan, where there's not actually a declared war, but they're being used to fight the Taliban who are hiding there, and operating the war in Afghanistan, and then what we see as a retaliation for the strikes against Taliban leaders in Pakistan was a suicide bombing against civilians, more or less CIA operatives, who were controlling those Predator drones. So you get these translations of risk from soldiers to civilians, and it confuses in many ways a lot of what the ethics of war have traditionally been about, which is that uniformed soldiers shooting at uniformed soldiers. It leads to this kind of asymmetric warfare and in many ways justifies guerrilla warfare and terrorism.
Dr. Arkin, on the flip side, you sort of explain in your book how, you know, we've always been likely to go to war. We've always been sort of warring people. So, you know, maybe there isn't any deterrent to be had in human beings going off to war. What do you think?
I just heard something strange there. But
oh, basically I was asking whether or not...
No, I heard you. I just heard another voice in the background.
Okay.
So let me speak to the notion of going off to war and the role of military technology and the asymmetric advantage in general. The question initially started whether we should have ethics at all in the fighting of warfare. And that's a decision our leaders have to make. President Obama, in the acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize, spoke rather eloquently about just war theory. And that is something our nation has chosen to subscribe to. We haven't signed all the treaties associated with that, but in many ways we are leaders associated with the ways in which our nation decides to conduct wars from a high moral standard in principle. And one, it does sound oxymoronic. The caller is correct in the sense that how can you really talk about moral war? This is the position that pacifists often take, and I'm sympathetic to that. I wish I knew a way to stop humans from killing each other in warfare, but war has persisted from time immemorial. So if war is going to continue, and I encourage those to make sure that war doesn't continue, but if it is going to continue, and I see it almost as inevitable as the other case, that we ensure that it be done to the highest ethical international standards that we agree upon. And for that particular reason, adhering to the jus ad bellum strategy, where technical warfare has an asymmetric advantage, it's not just robots. It's any new technology. Our nation would have to technically avoid the use of new military advances to prevent this asymmetric advantage from occurring.
problem, I think, with the asymmetric advantage is that in these kinds of situations, if it's really a just war and there's a just cause to the war, these technological arguments and the military superiority arguments aren't really operative. If, you know, after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, nobody was sitting around thinking, gee, is this going to be a just war for the United States to defend itself? Everybody was on board at that point. Where these matter are really the cases where it's less clear that it's a just war and that it's many cases a war of aggression that people have to be really coerced and convinced into joining.
Let's go next to Anne in Camp Hill. Good morning, Anne.
Hi, good morning. I have a question. Could you please refer me to any readings on this besides the website? And also, where do we stand globally on the other countries on this technology?
Okay. In helping you guys to respond to that question, actually, we can sort of put those two together. I'm going to make one quick suggestion. P.W. Singer has written a book called Wired for War. And in the latest edition of Newsweek, Singer writes an article about where we stand globally on this very point. And it's called Defending Against Drones. And that's if not already published, will be published in the next few days. Dr. Arkin, where do we stand globally? I mean, how are we at the forefront of this technology? Are others using this sort of technology against us?
Proliferation is a very real concern. We are the clear leaders in the terms of the development and deployment of these kinds of systems. It's been under development in the United States for 40, 50 years at high levels of funding and is only accelerating. But the British, the French, the Chinese, even terrorist organizations such as the Hezbollah have used drones in the past. The British are worried about small micro UAVs attacking during the London Olympics and other circumstances. It's not hard to create these kinds of systems.
This is Radio Smart Talk. I'm Craig Cohen, and the program is supported by the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry, the statewide voice of business. Support also comes from Pinnacle Health, a hospital and healthcare system in central Pennsylvania, offering services from prenatal to geriatrics from four campuses, Community, Cumberland, Harrisburg, and Polyclinic. A complete listing of locations and services can be found at pinnaclehealth.org. And support comes from Capital Blue Cross. For more than 70 years, Capital Blue Cross has provided the businesses and families of central Pennsylvania with health security through all the stages of life. Capital Blue Cross, then, now, always. We're discussing the implications of incorporating ethical protocols into autonomous robots for use in warfare on today's show. And our guests are Dr. Ronald Arkin, director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory at Georgia Tech. He's been conducting just such research for the U.S. Army. And Dr. Peter Asaro, founding member and co-director of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. We welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-729-7532. Or you can email us at smarttalk@witf.org. We also want to hear from our mobile community on this issue. Could ethically programmed robots be more humane in the field of battle than humans? Text us at 35253, type WITF space, then leave your comment. That's 35253, type WITF space, then your comment. Again, our phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Arkin, let's assume the Army says, okay, go ahead, build your ethical robots. Whose ethics? Who decides what a robot should determine is right or wrong in a given situation?
These ethics should be determined by international treaties and accords. I agree with Peter that we need to have discussions as to what is and isn't acceptable in terms of the ongoing principles of the Geneva Conventions and the like as well, too, which deal with humanity, military necessity, proportionality, and target discrimination. We have to make sure that those are all adhered to appropriately. So these are the same rules of engagement in terms of the ethical standards that should be upheld with our existing warfighting forces.
Do we, though, take into account certain ethical philosophies? I mean, are we literally thinking about, beyond the basic rules of engagement, programming a robot to consider Kant's categorical imperative or utilitarianism or something like that?
Deontology is built into, or the rights-based approaches are built into the Geneva Conventions and the laws of war, which respect those that have surrendered, those that have become wounded, respect the rights of non-combatants. It's not just force that rules. Proportionality is a utilitarian concept to some extent. It means choosing the right weapon for the particular task at hand. given its known destructive effects. So it's a combination of several different perspectives. Peter may have something to add to that as well.
All right, Peter, what do you think?
Obviously what people do in ethics and how the laws of ethics are constructed are mixed together different kinds of laws, different kinds of ethical principles, and it's a real kind of hodgepodge of different kinds of rules and philosophies and ethics. But I think the real challenges are that these robotic systems and computer systems don't really have the capability of evaluating situations, understanding values, and establishing values. Like how do they determine, you know, when is this life worth taking for some military objective and when is it not? And those are decisions that are very difficult for humans to make, but humans are much more capable of that than machines are. And I think if we're going to look at where we should be investing in technology, and as Ron said earlier, of course, a lot of these technologies don't provide, like the Patriot missile system, don't necessarily provide their operators with a lot of information about the situation that allows them to make a good decision. But I don't think the computer is going to be better at making that decision just because we have poorly informed humans making the decision now. I think if we're going to develop a new technology, we should develop a technology which makes it easier for humans to make good decisions rather than try to eliminate human decision-making and automate that with a machine.
We have some comments coming in. We have an email. In my opinion, autonomous robots are a bad idea. If you take humans out of war, yes, you are saving lives, but what would stop us from starting a war whenever we feel like it? I've served in and lost friends in combat. However, we chose to fight for a set of values and beliefs that we hold dear. Today's battlefield is too complex for a robot programmed within certain parameters to be as good as the people on the ground. What do you think about that thought, Dr. Arkin?
It is a complex environment. There's no doubt about it. But it's also becoming far too complex for human beings to function in. Further, I would also contend that these systems are not going to replace human beings in the battlefield. These will be embedded assets along with our troops, working alongside with them, dealing with narrow specialized missions such as counter-sniper operations or building clearing operations, where we've already seen ethical abuses occurring in Haditha and elsewhere, to avoid those kinds of situations, to take on what traditionally robotics has taken on, the most dangerous kinds of tasks for human beings, but not to fully replace humans in the battlefield. This will not be a landscape of robots in science fiction, as Hollywood would have us envision. Rather, it will be more like a canine corps embedded with your troops to carry out specific narrow tasks which become tractable due to the bounded morality. In other words, they don't have to have the full moral sense of a human being. They just have to understand a particular task, situation, scenario, and function in that particular context, and end up saving lives both of our soldiers, but equally importantly, of innocent non-combatants, as opposed to just rolling grenades through cracked doors and hoping for the best.
But what would keep some military power, someone somewhere, from essentially perverting any development of such robots to the point where they are used more frequently as a complete replacement for humanity?
Nothing more than would pervert our commanding officers right now from telling our soldiers to discard the laws of war and the rules of engagement, which unfortunately is sometimes done for the sheer sake of winning. If you don't trust your government, if you don't trust your forces, then we are in trouble whether we have manned forces or robotic forces.
You admitted earlier that the potential exists that no matter how carefully or effectively an autonomous robot is programmed, it could still act unethically. We have ways of punishing people who act unethically. We have systems in place for that. What could we do to punish an unethical robot?
Well, the robot is never to be punished because it's never the robot's fault. That's where I part company with the philosophers as well, too, who believe that when they develop this notion of self-will, these are automaton which are carrying out specific actions in compliance with human-derived laws of wars and rules of engagement. And if people choose to deploy them, they must be fully aware and fully cognizant of the responsibility of creating them, designing them, ordering them to war, manning them in war situations, and understanding if they choose to override their particular action. Part of our work has been in designing something called a responsibility advisor to make as transparent as possible an understanding of what it means to send these systems out into the battlefield to the operators of the field and commanders.
That said, Dr. Sorrow, I could imagine a circumstance where a robot does not operate as it's supposed to, whether we characterize that as an unethical act or not, or it just doesn't follow its programming as designed, and those in the military that use this equipment say, well, it's not our fault, it's the programmer's fault. And the programmer says, well, the military didn't use it right. How do we assess blame in a situation like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very complicated. And we do this to a certain extent in, say, liability cases. Like when an airliner crashes, we try to identify what the cause was and who was responsible for that cause. And there's certain mechanisms for that. But I wonder then if, you know, to throw it back at Ron, if he understands that if this is the case, then, you know, he as the designer of these systems may find himself in a, you know, war tribunal, a standing trial for war crimes caused by robots that he's designed or robots that his students designed, if there was a faulty vision system or a faulty decision system that you could trace back to the programmer and the roboticist might be liable for war crimes.
I fully understand that, and that's one of the reasons, again, why I have taken this activist stance among our community to make sure that these systems are deployed consistent with an ethical standard. But it's the same sort of thing, Craig. If, for example, you have a precision-guided munition, and suppose it's dropped from an aircraft fully intended to hit a particularly legitimate target, but one of the fins on it, which all too often happens, misbehaves, and it lands on a school. There's a whole notion of intentionality associated with war crimes and something else called the principle of double effect, which actually excuses collateral damage if it's unintended. Sounds strange again, but these are the principles that we adhere to in just war theory. So one of the more difficult things is to prove human intent. Was that bomb deliberately intended to kill non-combatants? Very difficult to prove in a war crimes tribunal for human beings, but much more easy to prove in the context of a data-constructed robotic system.
Perhaps, but I think when you start eliminating the human element more and more, then more and more of these decisions are being made by the machines, and there's more and more potential for engineering flaws to result in the loss of life and the killing of innocent people, that, you know, more of the responsibility for the atrocity of war sort of disappears from humans, right? It's more and more machines.
I disagree. You're assuming again that these things have some form of moral agency, and
No, like you said, with the fin falling off of the bomb, right? Well, nobody's responsible for that school.
But nobody's charging the bomb with a war crime.
Right. Well, that's right. It's no longer a crime, but those school kids are still dead.
Yeah, but the issue, what this was getting back to, the question of the chain of responsibility. Was it the designer of the bomb? Was it the person who manufactured it? Was
right.
it the quality control inspector?
So why do we then engage in a series of technological developments that eliminates all the people who might be responsible for these things?
These people are still responsible. I'm not saying that they're not. I say the same chain of responsibility that vests in that technology will vest in human responsibility for these autonomous systems as well.
This is Radio Smart Talk. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the implications of incorporating ethical protocols into autonomous robots for use in warfare with Dr. Ronald Arkin, director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory at Georgia Tech, who's been conducting just such research for the U.S. Army, and Dr. Peter Asaro, founding member and co-director of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. What do you think of Dr. Arkin's research? Could ethically programmed robots be more humane in the field of battle than humans? You can call us at 1-800-729-7532. Send your email to smarttalk@witf.org, and you can now text us at 35253, type WITF, space, then leave your comment. That's 35253, type WITF, space, and then your comment. And again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. We go next to Christian in Harrisburg. Good morning, Christian.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question comment was based off the email that came in a little while ago about when you're removing the risk factor for people to be directly involved when you use these robots. So my point is you're saving their lives, but you may be causing people to wage more war more often since they won't be directly in harm's way. There's no mutual fear or anything.
Thanks for the call, Dr. Arkin. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but you know that is one concept that concerns people about
right.
the idea of adding more robots into the mix, fewer human beings. It sort of reduces that deterrent to go to war in the first place.
And it's the jus ad bellum argument once again as well too. The whole notion is whether or not, and there's some strange hum coming over my phone line right now.
So. Yeah, we'll try and work that out. But go ahead.
Okay. Hold on, Peter. Can you answer this till they sort this out? It's just
I think if we look at the basis of just war theory itself, which Ron's argument rests on pretty firmly, the notion is that you're justifiable in killing an enemy soldier because they're intent on killing you once the war has begun. And so you have this sort of moral justification for killing, even if they're not actively shooting at you, because they're potentially shooting at you. But it's because of their threat to your life that you have a right to kill them. And I think the potential for a fully automated kind of warfare where your entire army is robotic and everybody else is a civilian, that you do kind of lose the sense that civilians are no longer immune from being killed by the other side. If they don't have any human, if there's no human soldiers left and you're being attacked by a robot army, why do you have to respect the civilians on the other side? And I think it really sort of short-circuits a lot of the logic of just war theory, which, of course, was conceived when there were only human soldiers.
All right. Dr. Arkin?
Yeah, it's interesting. A short circuit was no pun intended, I presume, in that case. The real issue, again, goes back to just war theory and the whole notion of what it takes to go off to war. When I was talking about this, actually, at the BBC a couple of years ago, one of the commenters said one of the things, look at what we see right now in media outlets. We see high-level antiseptic bombing runs that... Even right now from our Predator drones, you see a human being standing there, there's a flash, and then the human being is not standing there at that point. It's entirely possible, again, that when these systems are integrated, keep in mind, I do not see these, as Peter mentioned, as armies of robots. I don't see that ever happening. I'm just sorry. I can't see that as an outcome that is acceptable to the military for a whole bunch of reasons, including the warfighter ethos, that people actually want to sign up and go to war, at least a certain subset of us. But I see these systems as working alongside our troops, fighting with them, taking the dangerous duties out of their hand. It is an asymmetric technology, but it is not a unique asymmetric technology. The question is, does our nation want to stop military defense-related research for fear that we will create technologies that will give us a significant warfighting advantage? We have seen the payoff of that in the past. And if that's the stance that our nation chooses to take, so be it. But some might view that as putting us at a significant risk.
Dr. Arkin, let's imagine for a moment we've deployed an ethical robot. How would it conclude whether or not to conduct its mission, to, say, fire a weapon on an enemy? What specifically would it take into account?
Well, there's actually, again, it sounds strange as well, too. There is, these robots have no inherent right to self-defense, such as a human soldier does. So they can assume more risk on behalf of the non-combatant. They can actually act in a self-sacrificing way, trying to ferret out whether a suspect individual is truly a combatant or not before taking a shot. This is the difference of the first do no harm as opposed to the shoot first, ask questions later strategy. But basically, again, a human has to task this system with a mission. And it might be a mission such as take that house, clear that building using whatever force is necessary, conceivably. Then military necessity is established at that point in time by the human being. Then the system goes about its task. It conducts target discrimination as it moves forward. Please keep in mind, again, that these technologies do not exist at this point in time. Only proof of concept exists. So this is stuff that we're talking 10 to 20 or more years down the road. But after it's done the discrimination, it evaluates the proportionality appropriate for a particular target. After looking at the proportionality, it acts in a manner which is consistent with the principle of double intention, I should also have mentioned that responsibility had to be assumed by a human being prior to the establishment of military necessity. And so after the principle of double intention, which means exercise due care with regards to civilians, the determination of the weapon system, which will have the minimal impact but still be able to carry out the mission, is conducted. And only under those circumstances, when target discrimination is highly reliable, that due care has been exerted in respect to noncombatants and noncombatant property, and an appropriate system which respects that has been used, will the target be engaged.
Your research includes the incorporation of what you characterize as guilt.
Yes.
How could autonomous robots assess guilt in the battlefield to determine whether or not to fire on enemy combatants?
Okay, keep in mind we're using an analog of guilt here. We've done a lot of work in our laboratory in emotions historically. We've worked with the Sony Aibo, which is a robot dog. We're doing work for Samsung in complex, time-varying effective models of robotic behavior for humanoids. Forgive the highfalutin terms, I guess. What we have concerned ourselves here with is a set of moral emotions for this particular situation. Guilt plays a very interesting role in human being behavior because it is based on a particular act, and it typically will result in proactive constructive change. We have looked into cognitive science and looked at human models of guilt and have tried to deploy that in a way and have shown simulations how this can be put to work. The way in which we have done it in this particular context is for a system that is about to engage a target, say a predator or what have you, it could do a faster than real-time simulation of the consequences of deploying that, which no human being can effectively do. And there are no simulations that have this capability yet. But it can evaluate the explosive results of a particular weapon system. After the deployment of that, it does what's referred to as a battle damage assessment. It looks at the consequences of that, which could either be done by a human being or by the system itself if it had adequate resources to do that. It compares the pre-evaluation and the post-evaluation. If the post-evaluation, the after-the-fact evaluation, is significantly higher, we have a level of guilt which increases in one direction, monotonically, as we call it, to the point where if it exceeds a certain threshold, it will stop using that particular weapon system. It's interesting to note that McChrystal kind of did this in this General McChrystal in Afghanistan recently when a particular missile system that was used inadvertently killed 12 civilians. He stopped the use of that missile system until they understood it further. I'm not saying he felt guilty, but he also apologized under those circumstances. So there's a bit of an analog between that action as well.
But does it make sense to base a decision like that about whether to fire the next weapon based on the results of the last one?
If the consequences of an action are wrong, in other words, if the system did not fully understand the consequences of what it was doing and it recognizes that it made a mistake, yes, it makes sense to restrict it. Now, that doesn't preclude operator overrides of the system. Human beings, we have engineered into the system, and I must admit with some reluctance, the ability of humans to come in and turn things back on. But they must be informed of the responsibility before they are allowed to do that.
Well, now, Dr. Asara, let me bring you in on this point, because I've seen this part of the movie. This is the sort of the point in every science fiction film, rightly or wrongly, where the manual override malfunctions and now we're at the mercy of the robot. Of course, that's an extreme situation, but are we wrong to consider and worry about an extreme situation like that?
Well, I mean, the more general issue about technology and the way that technological development proceeds, I mean, there's always, you know, a group of smart engineers who try to foresee a lot of problems, but all technologies go through trial and error refinement and iterations, and, you know, whether it's learning through guilt the way that Ron has formulated it, or just, you know, seeing what doesn't work in the real world and then fixing that. The question is, in these cases, for these kinds of systems, you know, how many trials and errors are going to be acceptable? And when we're talking about innocent people that are getting killed as we learn to make these systems better, because I don't think out of the box they're going to be anything like, you know, human levels of performance.
Peter, but innocent people are being killed in the battlefield routinely.
Right, but that's not an excuse to
No, it's not an excuse. It is a goal to make that occur less than it's currently being. That's the intent. And I agree with you, these systems have to be proven before they are moved out into the battlefield to undertake those actions.
We received an interesting text here. Question, do you think anyone else will try to incorporate ethics into their robot war drones, or is that just something we're doing to set a good example?
Well, I think it's, you know, it is probably pretty unique to the U.S., but I think, you know, in terms of an international treaty, I think we could, one, just sort of ban autonomous weapons more generally, or if that proved not to be successful, and a kind of a worst-case scenario, then maybe we could try to have a treaty that required all such autonomous systems to have some kind of ethical system built in, but I would think that's less desirable than just banning them outright.
Dr. Arkin?
Yeah, I'm not. It's kind of interesting. Again, I'm not sure that even we are building ethical systems. This was one research project. I'm kind of a loner out there in actually designing these kinds of systems. And Peter, I don't know if you know anyone else that's doing it in this particular context either. But at least we are exploring this space. Whether this translates into something that will have a direct military relevance is an open question. But I have been presenting this work internationally. I've given talks on this on four continents already. So there is interest worldwide in it. Whether others actually step up to the bar, which is one of my goals, is I don't think I can do this, obviously, alone. I'm hoping to be able to create a vibrant research subcommunity that can answer many of the unanswered questions that remain.
Dr. Saro, any technological advancement could be potentially militarized. Earlier, Dr. Arkin talked about PackBots. The folks that make the Roomba vacuum cleaner provide versions of their PackBots that are equipped with tasers. Do you find scientists are increasingly concerned, as Dr. Arkin seems to be, with how their inventions will be used or potentially misused? Or has that simply always been a concern of science and discovery?
I think it's always been a concern, especially after the Manhattan Project, and scientists sort of took a step back and realized, okay, we did all this great science and innovation, and now we've created a weapon that threatens the whole human race. So there's been a discourse about that, really, since then. But I think, you know, with the age we live in now, the rapid transition of technologies from pieces of research that happen in a lab to something that you can, you know, download source code off the internet or find in a commercial product that you can plug together with some other commercial product. These things are really becoming very fluid and plug and play given the internet and digital technology that we have now. And I think that makes the development of these kinds of lethal autonomous systems much scarier because if we make a really good mind for identifying humans and shooting at them, that's a robotic system. What prevents that from being downloaded and put into a simple robot or something that somebody could build in a garage or something like that? I think these kinds of issues of proliferation are going to make these robotic systems very dangerous.
Dr. Arkin, you sort of alluded to this earlier, but how close are we to potentially deploying autonomous robots that can make ethical decisions based on guilt or what we might characterize as sort of an emotion like that? Is this really in our sights?
There's been one baby step which is taken, which is the three-year project which I've just recently completed on this. Right now, we are in the discussion phase. I'm routinely visiting a military as well as religious, as well as social, as well as collegiate and political organizations talking about this. It depends. Assuming that someone wanted to go ahead and pursue this full bore, I would estimate a minimum of 10 to 15 years before the systems and the necessary science could be worked out to be able to deploy this effectively.
But that's still much closer than I imagine some folks would think.
There are some that will argue. He will argue that it just can't be done ever. I don't take that particular perspective. And as I mentioned, if someone can show me some fundamental theoretical limitation, if I discover myself to admit that this should not be done.
Dr. Ron Arkin is Regents Professor and Director of the Mobile Robot Laboratory and Associate Dean of Research in the College of Computing at Georgia Tech. His latest book is Governing Lethal Behavior in Autonomous Robots. And Dr. Arkin will give a talk entitled Ethical Robots in Warfare at Lafayette College in Easton, PA on March 24th at 7 p.m. Dr. Arkin, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Peter Asaro is a self-proclaimed philosopher of science, technology, and media, and founding member and co-director of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. Dr. Asaro, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
The conversation continues at WITF.org, where I encourage you to share your comments about today's topic and program. If you have any additional questions we weren't able to address during today's show, I hope you'll post them there. We invite all Radio Smart Talk guests to monitor the site and respond when appropriate. You can also follow a link there to a short video demonstration of how autonomous robots could theoretically assess guilt in the battlefield to determine whether or not to fire on enemy combatants. And we encourage you to answer our poll question about today's program to visit our program post in the Smart Talk section of the website. Go to WITF.org and click on the Smart Talk logo right there on the main page, or find us under the news section at the top of the page. And as always, remember, you can listen back to this and all Radio Smart Talk programs there. Again, it's all at WITF.org.